teeth touched cold metal. I pulled it out. Underneath was the metal box, larger than I had imagined it. So big it almost filled the drawer. I maneuvered my hands around it and realized it was heavier than I expected too, and I almost dropped it as I lifted it out and set it on the floor. The box sat in front of me. For a moment I didn't know what I wanted to do, whether I even wanted to open it. What new shocks might it contain? Like memory itself, it might hold truths that I couldn't even begin to conceive of. Unimagined dreams and unexpected horrors. I was afraid. But, I realized, these truths are all I have. They are my past. They are what makes me human. Without them, I am nothing. Nothing but an animal. I breathed deeply, closing my eyes as I did so, and began to lift the lid. It moved a little way, but no further. I tried it again, thinking it was jammed, and then once more, before I realized. It was locked. Ben had locked it. I tried to remain calm, but an anger came then, unbidden. Who was he to have locked this box of memories? To keep me from what was mine? The key would be near, I was sure of it. I looked in the drawer. I opened out the towel and shook it loose. I stood up, tipped the pens and pencils out of the mug on the desk, and looked in there. Nothing. Desperate, I searched the other drawers as well as I could in the half-light. I could find no key, and realized it might be anywhere. Anywhere at all. I sank to my knees. A sound, then. A creak. So quiet I thought it might be my own body, but then another noise, breathing or a sigh. A voice. Ben's. Christine, it said, and then louder. Christine! What to do? I was sitting there, in his office, with the metal box that Ben thinks I have no memory of on the floor in front of me. I began to panic. A door opened. The landing light flicked on, illuminating the crack around the door. He was coming. I moved quickly. I put the box back, and, sacrificing silence for speed, slammed the drawer closed. Christine, he said again, footsteps on the landing. Christine, love. It's me, Ben. I shoved the pens and pencils back in the mug on the desk and then sank to the floor. The door began to open. I didn't know what I was about to do until I did it. I reacted instinctively from a level lower than gut. Help me, I said as he appeared at the bottom door. He was silhouetted against the light on the landing, and for a moment I really did feel the terror that I was affecting. Please! Help me! He switched on the light and came towards me. Christine! What's wrong? He said. He began to crouch down. I skirted back away from him until I was pressed against the wall under the window. Who are you? I said. I found I had begun to cry, to shake hysterically. I clawed at the wall behind me, clutched at the curtain that hung above me as if trying to pull myself upright. Ben stayed where he was, on the other side of the room. He held out his hand to me as if I was dangerous, a wild animal. It's me, he said. Your husband. My what? I said, and then, what's happening to me? You have amnesia, he said. We've been married for years. And then, as he made me the cup of cocoa that still sits in front of me, I let him tell me from scratch what I already knew. Sunday, 18th of November. That happened in the early hours of Saturday morning. Today is Sunday, midday or thereabouts. A whole day has gone, unrecorded. 24 hours lost. 24 hours spent believing everything Ben told me. Believing that I have never written a novel, never had a son. Believing it was an accident that robbed me of my past. Maybe, unlike today, Dr. Nash didn't call, and I didn't find this journal. Or perhaps he did, but I chose not to read it. I feel a chill What would happen if one day he decides never to call again? I would never find it, never read it, never even know it existed. I would not know my past. It would be unthinkable. I know that now. My husband is telling me one version of how I came to have no memory, my feelings another. I wonder if I have ever asked Dr. Nash what happened. Even if I have, can I believe what he says? The only truth I have is what is written in this journal. Written by me. I must remember that. Written by me. I think back to this morning. I remember the sun slammed through the curtains, waking me suddenly. My eyes flicked open to an unfamiliar scene and I was confused. Yet, though particular events didn't come to me, I had the sense of looking back on a wealth of history, not just a few short years. And I knew, however dimly, that that history contained a child of my own. In that fraction of a second before I was fully conscious, I knew that I was a mother. That I had borne a child, that mine was no longer the only body that I had a duty to nurture and protect. I turned over, aware of another body in the bed, an arm draped over my waist. I didn't feel alarmed, but secure, happy. I woke more fully and the images and feelings began to coalesce into truth and memory. First I saw my little boy, heard myself calling his name, Adam, and saw him running towards me, and then I remembered my husband, his name. I felt deeply in love. I smiled. The feeling of peace didn't last. I looked over at the man next to me, and his face was not the one I expected to see. A moment later I realized that I didn't recognize the room in which I had slept. Couldn't remember getting there. And then, finally, I understood that I could remember nothing clearly. Those brief, disconnected snatches had not been representative of my memories, but their sum total. Ben explained it to me, of course, or parts of it, at least. And this journal explained the rest, once Dr. Nash phoned me and I found it. I didn't have time to read it all. I called down, feigning a headache, and then had listened for the slightest movement downstairs, worried that Ben might come up at any moment with an aspirin and a glass of water. But I read enough. The journal told me who I am, how I came to be here, what I have, and what I have lost. It told me that all is not lost, that my memories are coming back, however slowly. Dr. Nash told me so on the day that I watched him read my journal. "You're remembering lots of things, Christine," he said. "There's no reason that won't continue." And the journal told me that the hidden run was a lie, that somewhere, hidden deep, I can remember what happened to me on the night I lost my memory. That it doesn't involve a car and icy roads, but champagne and flowers, and a knock on the door of a hotel room. And now I have a name. The name of the person I had expected to see when I opened my eyes this morning was not Ben. Ed. I woke expecting to be lying next to someone called Ed. At the time I didn't know who he was, this Ed. I thought perhaps he was nobody. It was a name I invented, plucked from nowhere. Or perhaps he was an old lover, a one-night stand that I have not quite forgotten. But now I have read this journal. I have learnt that I was assaulted in a hotel room. And so I know who this Ed is. He is the man who was waiting on the other side of the door that night. The man who attacked me. The man who stole my life. This evening I tested my husband. I didn't want to. Didn't even plan to. But I'd spent the whole day worrying. Why had he lied to me? Why? And does he lie to me every day? Is there only one version of the past that he tells me, or several? I need to trust him, I thought. I have no one else. We were eating lamb. A cheap joint, fatty and overcooked. I was pushing the same forkful around my plate, dipping it in gravy, bringing it to my mouth, putting it down again. "How did I get to be like this?" I asked. I had tried to summon up the vision of the hotel room, but it had remained elusive, just out of reach. In a way, I was glad. Ben looked up from his own plate, his eyes wide with surprise. "Christine," he said. "Darling, I don't..." "Please," I interrupted him. "I need to know." He put his knife and fork down. "Very well," he said. "I need you to tell me everything," I said, "everything." He looked at me, his eyes narrow.
"You're sure?"
"Yes," I said. I hesitated, but then I decided to say it. Some people might think it would be better not to tell me all the details, especially if they were upsetting, but I don't think that. I think you should tell me everything, so that I can decide for myself what to feel. Do you understand?"
"Chris," he said, "what do you mean?"
I looked away. My eyes rested on the photograph of the two of us that sat on the sideboard. "I don't know," I said. "I know I wasn't always like this, and now I am. So something must have happened. Something bad. I'm just saying that I know that. I know it must have been something awful. But even so, I want to know what. I have to know what it was, what happened to me. Don't lie to me, Ben," I said. "Please." He reached across the table and took my hand. "Darling, I would never do that." And then he began. "It was December," he said. "Icy roads." And I listened, with a mounting sense of dread, as he told me about the car accident. When he had finished, he picked up his knife and fork and carried on eating.
"You're sure?"
I said. "You're sure it was an accident?" He sighed.
"Why?"
I tried to calculate how much to say. I didn't want to reveal that I was writing again, keeping a journal, but wanted it to be as honest as I could. "Earlier today I got an odd feeling," I said. "Almost like a memory. Somehow it felt like it had something to do with why I'm like this."
"What sort of feeling?"
"I don't know."
"A memory?"
"Sort of."
"Well, did you remember specific things about what happened?"
I thought of the hotel room, the candles, the flowers, the feeling that they had not been from Ben, that it was not him I had opened the door to in that room. I thought, too, of the feeling that I could not breathe.
"What sort of thing?" I said. "Any details, really? The type of car that hit you. Even just the color, whether you saw who was driving it?" I wanted to scream at him. "Why are you asking me to believe I was hit by a car? Can it really be that it is an easier story to believe than whatever did happen?" An easier story to hear, I thought, or an easier one to tell. I wondered what he would do if I was to say, "Actually, no. I don't even remember being hit by a car. I remember being in a hotel room, waiting for someone who wasn't you."
"No," I said, "not really. It was more just a general impression."
"A general impression?" he said. "What do you mean, a general impression?"
He had raised his voice, sounded almost angry. I was no longer sure I wanted to continue the discussion.
"Nothing," I said. "It was nothing. Just an odd feeling, as if something really bad were happening, and a feeling of pain, but I don't remember any details."
He seemed to relax.
"It's probably nothing," he said. "Just the mind playing tricks on you. Try to just ignore it."
Ignore it, I thought. How could he ask me to do that? Was he frightened of me remembering the truth?
"It is possible, I suppose. He has already told me today that I was hit by a car. He cannot enjoy the thought of being exposed as a liar, even for the rest of the one day that I could hold on to the memory. Particularly if he is lying for my benefit. I can see how believing I was hit by a car would be easier for both of us, but how will I ever find out what really happened? and who I had been waiting for in that room. "Okay," I said, because what else could I say? "You're probably right." We went back to our lamb, now cold. Another thought came then. Terrible. Brutal. What if he is right? If it was a hit and run? What if my mind had invented the hotel room, the attack? It might all be invention, imagination, not memory. Was it possible that, unable to comprehend the simple fact of an accident on an icy road, I had made it all up? If so, then my memory is not working. Things are not coming back to me. I am not getting better at all, but going mad. I found my bag and upended it over the bed. Things tumbled out. My purse, my floral diary, a lipstick, a powder contact, some tissues, a mobile phone, and then another. A packet of mints, some loose coins, a yellow square of paper. I sat on the bed, searching through the detritus. I fished out the tiny diary first, and thought I was in luck when I saw Dr. Nash's name scrawled in black ink at the back. But then I saw that the number beneath it had the word "office" next to it in brackets. It was Sunday. He wouldn't be there. The yellow paper was gummed along one edge, with dust and hair sticking to it, but otherwise blank. I was beginning to wonder what on earth had made me think, even for a moment, that Dr. Nash would have given me his personal number, when I remembered reading that he had written his number in the front of my journal. "Ring me if you get confused," he'd said. I found it, then picked up both phones. I couldn't remember which one Dr. Nash had given me. The larger of the two I checked quickly, seeing that every call was from or to Ben. The second, the one that flipped open, had hardly been used. Why had Dr. Nash given it to me, I thought, if not for this? What am I now, if not confused? I opened it and dialed his number, then pressed call. Silence for a few moments, and then a buzzy ring, interrupted by a voice. "Hello," he said. He sounded sleepy, though it wasn't late. "Who is this?" "Dr. Nash," I said, whispering. I could hear Ben downstairs where I had left him, watching some kind of talent show on the television. Singing, laughter, sprinkled with punches of applause. "It's Christine." There was a pause. A mental readjustment. "Oh. Okay. How..." I felt an unexpected plunge of disappointment. He didn't sound pleased to be hearing from me. "I'm sorry," I said. "I got your number from the front of my journal." "Of course," he said. "Of course. How are you?" I said nothing. "Is everything okay?" "I'm sorry," I said. The words fell out of me, one after another. "I need to see you. Now. Or tomorrow. Yes, tomorrow. I had a memory. Last night I wrote it down. A hotel room. Someone knocked on the door. I couldn't breathe. I..." "Dr. Nash?" "Christine," he said, "slow down. What happened?" I took a breath. "I had a memory. I'm sure it has something to do with why I can't remember anything. But it doesn't make sense. Ben says I was hit by a car." I heard movement, as if he was adjusting his position, and another voice, a woman's. "It's nothing," he said quietly, and he muttered something I couldn't quite hear. "Dr. Nash," I said. "Dr. Nash, was I hit by a car?" "I can't really talk right now," he said, and I heard the woman's voice again, louder now, complaining. I felt something stir within me. Anger or panic. "Please," I said. The word hissed out of me. Silence at first, and then his voice again, now with authority. "I'm sorry," he said. "I'm a little busy. Have you written it down?" I didn't answer. Busy. I thought of him and his girlfriend, wondered what it was that I'd interrupted. He spoke again. "What you've remembered, is it written in your journal? Make sure you write it down." "Okay," I said, but he interrupted. "We'll talk tomorrow. I'll call you on this number, I promise." Relief, mixed with something else, something unexpected, Harder to define. Happiness? Delight? No, it was more than that. Part anxiety, part certainty, suffused with a tiny thrill of pleasure to come. I still feel it as I write this an hour or so later, but now know it for what it is. Something I don't know that I've ever felt before. Anticipation. But anticipation of what? That he will tell me what I need to know? That he will confirm that my memories are beginning to trickle back to me? That my treatment is working? Or is it more? I think of how I must have felt as he touched me in the car park. What I must have been thinking to ignore a call from my husband. Perhaps the truth is more simple. I'm looking forward to talking to him. Yes, I had said when he told me he would call. Yes, please. But by then the line was already dead. I thought of the woman's voice, realized they had been in bed. I dismissed the thought from my mind. To chase it would be to go truly mad.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook, so please check your library for the next part of this audiobook. Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program. This is Audible.
Before I Go to Sleep by S.J. Watson. Monday, 19th of November. The cafe was busy. One of a chain. Everything was green or brown, and disposable, though, according to the posters that dotted the carpeted walls, in an environmentally friendly way. I drank my coffee out of a paper cup, dauntingly huge, as Dr. Nash settled himself into the armchair opposite the one into which I had sunk. It was the first time I'd had the chance to look at him properly, or the first time today at least, which amounts to the same thing. He had called, on the phone that flips open, not long after I had cleared away the remains of my breakfast and then picked me up an hour or so later, after I had read most of my journal. I stared out of the window as we drove to the coffee shop. I was feeling confused, desperately so. This morning, when I woke, even though I could not be certain I knew my own name, I knew somehow that I was both an adult and a mother, although I had no inkling that I was middle-aged and my son was dead. My day so far had been brutally disorientating, one shock after another, the bathroom mirror, the scrapbook, and then later this journal, culminating in the belief that I do not trust my husband. I had felt disinclined to examine anything else too closely. Now, though, I could see that Dr. Nash was younger than I had expected, and though I had written that he did not need to worry about watching his weight, I could see that this did not mean he was as skinny as I had supposed. He had a solidness to him, emphasized by the too large jacket that hung from his shoulders and out of which his surprisingly hairy forearms poked infrequently. "How are you feeling today?" he said, once settled. I shrugged. "I'm not sure. Confused, I suppose." He nodded. "Go on." I pushed away the biscuit that Dr. Nash had given me, though I hadn't asked for it. "Well, I woke up kind of knowing that I was an adult. I didn't realize I was married, but I wasn't exactly surprised that there was someone in bed with me." "That's good, though," he began. I interrupted. "But yesterday I wrote that I woke up and knew I had a husband." "You're still writing in your book, then," he said, and I nodded. "Did you bring it today?" "I had. It was in my bag. But there were things in it I didn't want him to read, didn't want anyone to. Personal things. My history. The only history I have. Things I'd written about him." "I forgot," I lied. I couldn't tell if he was disappointed. "Okay," he said. "It doesn't matter. I can see it must be frustrating that one day you remember something and the next it seems to have gone again. But it's still progress. Generally, you're remembering more than you were." I wondered if what he'd said was still true. In the first few entries of this journal, I had written of remembering my childhood, my parents, a party with my best friend. I had seen my husband when we were young and first in love. Myself writing a novel, but since then? Lately, I have been seeing only the son I have lost, and the attack that left me like this. Things that might almost be better for me to forget. You said you were worried about Ben. What he's saying about the cause of your amnesia. I swallowed. What I had written yesterday had seemed distant, removed, almost fictional. A car accident. Violence in a hotel room. Neither had seemed like anything to do with me, yet I had no choice but to believe that I had written the truth. That Ben had really lied to me about how I ended up like this. Go on, he said. I told him what I'd written down, starting with Ben's story about the accident, and finishing with my recollection of the hotel room. Though I mentioned neither the sex we'd been in the middle of when the memory of the hotel room came to me, nor the romance, the flowers, the candles and champagne it had contained. I watched him as I spoke. He occasionally murmured an encouragement, and even scratched his chin and narrowed his eyes at one point. Though the expression was more thoughtful than surprised. You knew this, didn't you? I said when I'd finished. You knew all of this already. He put down his drink. Not exactly, no. I knew that it wasn't a car accident that caused your problems, although since reading your journal the other day I now know that Ben has been telling you that it was. I also knew that you must have been staying in a hotel on the night of on the night you lost your memory. But the other details you mentioned are new, and as far as I know, this is the first time you've actually remembered anything yourself. This is good news, Christine. Good news. I wondered if he thought I should be pleased. So it's true, I said, it wasn't a car accident. He paused, then said, No. No, it wasn't. But why didn't you tell me Ben was lying? When you read my journal, why didn't you tell me the truth? Because Ben must have his reasons, he said, and it didn't feel right to tell you he was lying. Not then. So you lied to me too. No, he said, I've never lied to you. I never told you it was a car accident. I thought of what I had read this morning, but the other day, I said, in your office, we talked about it. He shook his head. I wasn't talking about an accident, he said. You said that Ben had told you how it happened, so I thought you knew the truth. I hadn't read your journal then, don't forget. We must have got ourselves mixed up. I could see how it might happen. Both of us skirting around an issue we didn't want to mention by name. So what did happen, I said, in that hotel room? What was I doing there? I don't know everything, he said. Then tell me what you do know. The words emerged angrily, but it was too late to snatch them back. I watched as he brushed a non-existent crumb from his trousers. You're certain you want to know? He said. I felt like he was giving me one final chance. You can still walk away, he seemed to be saying. You can go on with your life without knowing what I'm about to tell you. But he was wrong. I couldn't. Without the truth, I am living less than half a lie. Yes, I said. His voice was slow, faltering. He began sentences only to abort them a few words later. The story was a spiral, as if circling round something awful, something better left unsaid. Something that made a mockery of the idle chat I imagine the cafe is more used to. It's true. You were attacked. It was... He paused. Well, it was pretty bad. You were discovered wandering in the street, confused. You weren't carrying any identification at all and had no memory of who you were or what had happened. There were head injuries. The police initially thought you had been mugged. Another pause. You were found wrapped in a blanket, covered in blood. I felt myself go cold. Who found me? I said. I'm not sure. Ben? No, Not Ben, no. A stranger. Whoever it was calmed you down, called an ambulance. You were admitted to hospital, of course. There was some internal bleeding and you needed an emergency operation. But how did they know who I was? For an awful moment, I thought perhaps they had never discovered my identity. Perhaps everything, an entire history, even my name, was given to me the day I was discovered. Even Adam. Dr. Nash spoke. It wasn't difficult, he said. You'd checked into the hotel under your own name, and Ben had already contacted the police to report you as missing, even before you were found. I thought of the man who had knocked on the door of that room. The man I had been waiting for. Ben didn't know where I was? No, he said. Apparently he had no idea. Or who I was with? Who did this to me? No, he said. Nobody was ever arrested. There was very little evidence to work with, and, of course, you couldn't really help the police with their investigations. It was assumed that whoever attacked you removed everything from the hotel room and then left you and fled. No one saw anyone go in or leave. Apparently the hotel was busy that night. Some kind of function in one of the rooms. Lots of people coming and going. You were probably unconscious for some time after the attack. It was the middle of the night when you went downstairs and left the hotel. No one saw you go. I sighed. I realized the police would have closed the case years ago. To everyone but me, even to Ben, this was old news, ancient history. I will never know who did this to me. And why? Not unless I remember. What happened then? I said, after I was taken to hospital. The operation was successful, but there were secondary effects. There was difficulty in stabilizing you after surgery. Your blood pressure, in particular, he paused. You lapsed into a coma for a while. A coma? Yes, he said. It was touch and go, but, well, you were lucky. You were in the right place, and they treated your condition aggressively. You came round, but then it became apparent that your memory had gone. At first they thought it might be temporary, a combination of the head injury and anoxia. It was a reasonable assumption. I'm sorry, I said. Anoxia. I had stumbled over the word. Sorry, he said. Oxygen deprivation. I felt my head begin to swim. Everything started to shrink and distort, as though it were getting smaller or me bigger. I heard myself speak, oxygen deprivation. Yes, he said. You had symptoms of a severe lack of oxygen to the brain, consistent with carbon dioxide poisoning, though there was no other evidence for this, or strangulation. There were marks on your neck that suggested this. But the most likely explanation was thought to be near drowning. He paused, as I absorbed what he was telling me. Did you remember anything about almost drowning? I closed my eyes. I saw nothing but a card on a pillow upon which I see the words, I love you. I shook my head. You recovered, but your memory didn't improve. You stayed in the hospital for a couple of weeks. In the intensive care unit at first, and then the general ward. When you were well enough to be moved, you were transported back to London. Back to London? Of course. I was found near a hotel. I must have been away from home. I asked where it was. In Brighton, he said. Do you have any idea why you might have been there? Any connection to that area? I tried to think of holidays, but nothing came. No, I said, none. None that I know of, anyway. It might help to go there, at some point, to see if you remember. I felt myself go cold. I shook my head. He nodded, okay. Well, there could be any number of reasons why you'd be there, of course. Yes, I thought. But only one that incorporated flickering candles and bunches of roses that didn't include my husband. Yes, I said. Of course. I wondered if either of us was going to mention the word affair, and how Ben must have felt when he realized where I had been, and why. It struck me then, the reason Ben had not given me the real explanation for my amnesia. Why would he want to remind me that once, however briefly, I had chosen another man over him? I felt a chill. I had chosen someone over my husband. And look at the price I had paid. What happened then? I said. Did I move back in with Ben? He shook his head. No. No, he said. You were still very ill. You had to stay in the hospital. For how long? You were in the general ward at first for a few months, and then you were moved. He hesitated. I thought I would have to ask him to continue, and then said, to a psychiatric ward. The word shook me. A psychiatric ward. I imagined a fearful place full of crazy people, howling, deranged. I could not see myself there. Yes. But why? Why there? He spoke softly, but his tone betrayed annoyance. I felt suddenly convinced we had been through all this before, perhaps many times, presumably before I had begun to keep my journal. It was more secure, he said. You had made a reasonable recovery from your physical injuries by now, but your memory problems were at their worst. You didn't know who you were or where. You were exhibiting symptoms of paranoia, claiming the doctors were conspiring against you. You kept trying to escape. He waited. You were becoming increasingly unmanageable. You were moved for your own safety, as well as the safety of others. Of others? You occasionally lashed out. I tried to imagine what it must have been like. I pictured someone waking up every day confused, not sure who they were, or where, or why they'd been put in hospital, asking for answers and not getting them, being surrounded by people who knew more about them than they did. It must have been hell. I remembered that we were talking about me. And then? He didn't answer. I saw his eyes go up, and he looked past me, towards the door, as if he were watching it, waiting. But there was no one there. It did not open. No one left or came in. I wondered if he was actually dreaming of escape. Dr. Nash, I said, what happened then? You stayed there for a while, he said. His voice was almost a whisper now. He has told me this before, I thought. But this time he knows I will write it down and carry it with me for more than a few hours. How long? He said nothing. I asked him again, how long? He looked up at me, his face a mixture of sadness and pain. 7 years. He paid, and we left the coffee shop. I felt numb. I don't know what I was expecting, where I thought I had lived out the worst of my illness, but I didn't think it would be there, not in the middle of all that pain. As we walked, Dr. Nash turned to me. Christine, he said, I have a suggestion. I noticed how casually he spoke, as if he was asking which flavour ice cream I would prefer, a casualness that can only be affected. Go on, I said. I think it might be helpful for you to visit the ward where you were admitted, he said. The place you spent all that time. My reaction was instant, automatic. No, I said, why? You're experiencing memory, he said. Think of what happened when we went to visit your old house. I nodded. You remembered something then. I think it might happen again. We might trigger more. But you don't have to, but... Look, I'll be honest. I've already made the arrangements with them. They'd be happy to welcome you, us, any time. I only have to ring to let them know we're on our way. I'd come with you. If you felt distressed or uncomfortable, we could leave. It'll be fine, I promise. You think it might help me to get better? Really?
I don't know, he said, but it might.
When?
When do you want to go?
He stopped walking. I realized the car we were standing next to must be his.
Today, he said, I think we should go today.
And then he said something odd.
We don't have time to lose.
I didn't have to go. Dr. Nash didn't force me to agree to the trip, but though I can't remember doing so, can't remember much at all, in fact, I must have said yes. The journey was not long, and we were silent. I could think of nothing. Nothing to say, nothing to feel. My mind was empty. Scooped out. I took my journal out of my bag, not caring that I had told Dr. Nash I didn't have it with me, and wrote that last entry in it. I wanted to record every detail of our conversation. I did it silently, almost without thinking, and we didn't speak as he parked the car, nor as we walked through the antiseptic corridors with their smell of stale coffee and fresh paint. People were wheeled past us on trolleys, attached to drips. Posters peeled off the walls. Overhead lights flickered and buzzed. I could think only of the 7 years I had spent there. It felt like a lifetime, one I remembered nothing of. We came to a stop outside a double door. Fisher Ward. Dr. Nash pressed a button on an intercom mounted on the wall, then mumbled something into it. He is wrong, I thought as the door swung open. I did not survive that attack. The Christine Lucas who opened that hotel room door is dead. Another double door. You okay, Christine? He said as the first door closed behind us, sealing us in. I said nothing. This is a secure unit. I was hit with a sudden conviction that the door behind me was closing forever. That I would not be leaving. I swallowed. I see, I said. The inner door began to open. I didn't know what I would see beyond it, couldn't believe I had ever been here before. Ready, he said. A long corridor. There were doors off each side, and as we walked I could see that they opened into glass-windowed rooms. In each was a bed, some made, some unmade. Some occupied, most not. The patients here suffer from a variety of problems, said Dr. Nash. Many show schizoaffective symptoms, but there are those with bipolarity, acute anxiety, depression. I looked in one window. A girl was sitting on the bed, naked, staring at the television. In another, a man sat on his haunches, rocking, his arms wrapped around his knees as if to shield himself from the cold. Are they locked in? I said. The patients here have been detained under the Mental Health Act, also known as sectioning. They're here for their own good, but against their wishes. Their own good?
Yes, they're a danger either to themselves or to others. They need to be kept secure. We carried on walking. A woman looked up as I passed her room, and though our eyes made contact, hers betrayed no expression. Instead, she slapped herself, still looking at me, and when I winced, she did it again. A vision flitted through me. Visiting a zoo as a child, watching a tiger pace up and down her cage. But I pushed it away and carried on, resolving to look neither left nor right. Why did they bring me here? I said. Before you were here, you were in the general medical ward, in a bed, just like everybody else. You would spend some weekends at home with Ben, but you became more and more difficult to manage.
Difficult?
You would wander off. Ben had to start locking the doors to the house. You became hysterical a couple of times, convinced that he had hurt you, that you were being locked in against your will. For a while you were okay when you got back to the ward, but then you started demonstrating similar behaviours there, too.
So they had to find a way of locking me in, I said.
We had reached a nursing station. A man in uniform sat behind a desk, entering something on a computer.
He looked up as we approached and said the doctor would be with us soon. He invited us to take a seat. I scanned his face. The crooked nose, the gold-studded earring, hoping something would ignite a glimmer of familiarity. Nothing. The ward seemed utterly foreign. "Yes," said Dr. Nash, "you'd gone missing. For something like 4.5 hours. You were picked up by the police, down by the canal, dressed only in pyjamas and a gown. Ben had to collect you from the station. You wouldn't go with any of the nurses. They had no choice." He told me that right away Ben began to campaign to have me moved. He felt that a psychiatric ward was not the best place for you. He was right, really. You weren't dangerous. Either to yourself or to others. It's even possible that being surrounded by those who were more ill than you was making you worse. He wrote to the doctors, the head of the hospital, your MP, but nothing was available. "And then," he said, "a residential centre for people with chronic brain injuries opened. He lobbied hard and you were assessed and thought to be suitable, though funding was an issue. Ben had had to take a break from work to look after you and couldn't afford to fund it himself, but he wouldn't take no for an answer. Apparently he threatened to go to the press with your story. There were meetings and appeals and so on, but eventually he was successful and you were accepted as a patient, with the state agreeing to pay for your stay as long as you were ill. You were moved there about 10 years ago. I thought of my husband, tried to imagine him writing letters, campaigning, threatening. It didn't seem possible. The man I had met that morning seemed humble, deferential, not weak, exactly, but accepting. He didn't seem like the kind of person to make waves. I am not the only one, I thought, whose personality has changed because of my injury." "The home was fairly small," said Dr. Nash, "a few rooms in a rehab centre. There weren't many other residents, lots of people to help look after you. You had a little more independence there. You were safe, you made improvements." "But I wasn't with Ben." "No. He lived at home. He needed to carry on working. And he couldn't do that and look after you. He decided..." A memory flashed through me, tearing me suddenly back into the past. Everything was slightly out of focus and had a haze around it, and the images were so bright I almost wanted to look away. I saw myself walking through these same corridors, being led back towards a room that I dimly understood as mine. I am wearing carpet slippers, a blue gown with ties up the back. The woman with me is black, wearing a uniform. "Here you go, hun," she says to me. "Look who's here to see you." She lets go of my hand and guides me towards the bed. A group of strangers are sitting around it, watching me. I see a man with dark hair and a woman wearing a beret, but I can't make out their faces. "I'm in the wrong room," I want to say. "There's been a mistake." But I say nothing. A child, 4 or 5 years old, stands up. He had been sitting on the edge of the bed. He comes towards me, running, and he says, "Mummy." And I see that he is talking to me. And only then do I realize who he is. Adam. I crouch down, and he runs into my arms, and I hold him and kiss the top of his head, and then I stand. "Who are you?" I say to the group around the bed. "What are you doing here?" The man looks suddenly sad. The woman with the beret stands and says, "Chris, Chrissy, it's me. You know who I am, don't you?" And then comes towards me, and I see that she is crying. "No," I say, "no! Get out! Get out!" And I turn to leave the room, and there is another woman there, standing behind me, and I don't know who she is, or how she got there. And I start to cry. I begin to sink to the floor, but the child is there, holding onto my knees. And I don't know who he is, but he keeps calling me Mummy, saying it over and over again, "Mummy, Mummy, Mummy." And I don't know why, or who he is, or why he is holding me.
A hand touched my arm. I flinched as if stung. A voice. Christine. Are you okay? Dr. Wilson is here. I opened my eyes, looked around. A woman wearing a white coat stood in front of us. Dr. Nash, she said. She shook his hand, and then turned to me. Christine? Yes, I said. Pleased to meet you, she said. I'm Hilary Wilson. I took her hand. She was a little older than me. Her hair was beginning to turn grey, and a pair of half-moon glasses dangled on a gold chain round her neck. How do you do? She said. And from nowhere I felt certain I had met her before. She nodded down the corridor. Shall we? Her office was large, lined with books, piled with boxes of spilling papers. She sat behind a desk and indicated two chairs opposite it, into which Dr. Nash and I sank. I watched her take a file from the pile on her desk and open it. Now, my dear, she said, let's have a look. Her image froze. I knew her. I had seen her picture as I lay in the scanner, and though I hadn't recognized it at the time, I did now. I had been here before. Many times. Sitting where I am now, in this chair or one like it, watching her making notes in a file as she peered through her glasses, held delicately to her eyes. I've met you before, I said. I remember. Dr. Nash looked over at me, then back to Dr. Wilson. Yes, she said. Yes, you have. Though not that often. She explained that she'd only just started working here when I moved out, and that at first I wasn't even on her caseload. It's certainly most encouraging that you remember me, though, she said. It's been a long time since you were resident here. Dr. Nash leaned forward and said it might help me to see the room in which I'd lived. She nodded and squinted in the file. Then, after a minute, said she didn't know which it was. It's possible that you moved around a fair old bit in any case, she said. Many of the patients do. Could we ask your husband? According to the file, he and your son Adam visited you almost every day. I had read about Adam this morning, and felt a flash of happiness at the mention of his name, and relief that I'd seen a little of him growing up. But shook my head, no, I said. I'd rather not ring Ben. Dr. Wilson didn't argue. A friend of yours called Claire seemed to be something of a regular too. How about her? I shook my head. We're not in touch. Ah, she said, what a pity. But never mind. I can tell you a little bit of what life was like here back then. She glanced at her notes, then clasped her hands together. Your treatment was mostly handled by a consultant psychiatrist. You underwent sessions of hypnosis, but I'm afraid any success was limited and unsustained. She read further. You didn't receive a great deal of medication. A sedative, occasionally. Though that was more to help you sleep. It can get quite noisy in here, as I'm sure you can understand, she said. I recalled the howling I'd imagined earlier, wondering if that might have once been me. What was I like? I said. Was I happy? She smiled. Generally, yes. You were well liked. You seemed to make friends with one of the nurses in particular. What was her name? She scanned her notes. I'm afraid it doesn't say. You played a lot of solitaire. Solitaire? A card game. Perhaps Dr. Nash can explain later. She looked up. According to the notes, you were occasionally violent, she said. Don't be alarmed, it's not unusual in cases like this. People who have suffered severe head trauma will often exhibit violent tendencies, particularly when there has been damage to the part of the brain that allows self-restraint. Plus, patients with amnesia, such as yours, often have a tendency to do something we call confabulation. Things around them don't seem to make sense, and so they feel compelled to invent details about themselves and other people around them, or about their history,
What has happened to them? It's thought to be due to the desire to fill gaps in the memory. Understandable in a way. But it can often lead to violent behaviour when the amnesiac's fantasy is contradicted. Life must have been very disorientating for you, particularly when you had visitors. Visitors? Suddenly I was afraid I might have hit my son. What did I do? You occasionally lashed out at some of the staff, she said, but not at Adam. My son? Not according to these notes, no. I sighed, not entirely relieved. We have some pages from a sort of diary that you were keeping, she said. Might it be helpful for you to take a look at them? You might find it easier to understand your confusion. This felt dangerous. I glanced at Dr. Nash, and he nodded. She pushed a sheet of blue paper over to me, and I took it, at first frightened even to look at it. When I did, I saw that it was covered in an unruly scrawl. At the top, the letters were well formed, and kept neatly within the printed lines that ran across the page. But towards the bottom, they were large and messy, inches tall, just a few words across. Though dreading what I might see, I began to read. 8:15 a.m. Read the first entry. I have woken up. Ben is here. Directly underneath I had written, 8:17 a.m. Ignore that last entry. It was written by someone else. And underneath that, 8:20. I am awake. Now. Before I was not. Ben is here. My eyes flicked further down the page. 9:45. I have just woken up. For the very first time. And then, a few lines later. 10:07. Now, I am definitely awake. All these entries are a lie. I am awake now. I looked up. This was really me, I said. Yes. For a long time it seemed that you were in a perpetual state of feeling that you had just woken up from a very long, very deep sleep. Look here. Dr. Wilson pointed at the page in front of me and began quoting entries from it. I have been asleep forever. It was like being dead. I have only just woken up. I can see again for the first time. They apparently encouraged you to write down what you are feeling, in an effort to get you to remember what had happened before, but I'm afraid you just became convinced that all the preceding entries had been written by someone else. You began to think people here were conducting experiments on you, keeping you against your will. I looked at the page again. The whole sheet was filled with almost identical entries, each just a few minutes apart. I felt myself go cold. Was I really this bad? I said. My words seemed to echo in my head. For a while? Yes, said Dr. Nash. Your notes indicate that you retained memory for only a few seconds, sometimes a minute or two. That time has gradually lengthened over the years. I could not believe I had written this. It seemed to be the work of someone whose mind was completely fractured, exploded. I saw the words again. It was like being dead. I'm sorry, I said. I can't. Dr. Wilson took the sheet from me. I understand, Christine. It's upsetting. Panic hit me then. I stood up, but the room began to spin. I want to leave. I said, this isn't me. It can't have been me. I would never hit people. I would never. I just... Dr. Nash stood too, and then Dr. Wilson. She stepped forward, colliding with her desk, sending papers flying. A photograph spilled to the floor. Dear God, I said, and she looked down, then crouched to cover it with another sheet. But I had seen enough. Was that me? I said, my voice rising to a scream. Was that me? The photograph was of the head of a young woman. Her hair had been pulled back from her face. At first it looked as though she was wearing a Halloween mask. One eye was open and looked at the camera. The other was closed by a huge purple bruise, and both lips were swollen, pink, lacerated with cuts. Her cheeks were distended, giving her whole face a grotesque appearance. I thought of pulped fruit, of plums, rotten and bursting. "Was that me?" I screamed, even though, despite the swollen, distorted face, I could see that it was. My memory splits there, fractured in two. Part of me was calm, quiet, serene. It watched as the other part of me thrashed and screamed and had to be restrained by Dr. Nash and Dr. Wilson. "You really ought to behave," it seemed to be saying. "This is embarrassing." But the other part was stronger. It had taken over, become the real me. I shouted out again and again, and turned and ran for the door. Dr. Nash came after me. I tore it open and ran. Though where could I go? An image of bolted doors, alarms, a man chasing me, my son crying. "I have done this before," I thought. "I have done all this before." My memory blanks. They must have calmed me down, somehow. Persuaded me to go with Dr. Nash. The next thing I can remember is being in his car, sitting next to him as he drove. The sky was beginning to cloud over, the streets grey, somehow flattened out. He was talking, but I couldn't concentrate. It was as if my mind had tripped, fallen back into something else, and now couldn't catch up. I looked out of the windows, at the shoppers and the dog walkers, at the people with their prams and their push bikes. And I wondered whether this search for truth, was really what I wanted. Yes, it might help me to improve, but how much can I hope to gain? I don't expect that I will ever wake up knowing everything, as normal people do, knowing what I did the day before, what plans I have for the day that follows. What circuitous route has led me to here and now, to the person I am? The best I can hope for is that one day looking in the mirror will not be a total shock. That I will remember I married a man called Ben and lost a son called Adam. That I will not have to see a copy of my novel to know that I had written one. But even that much seems unattainable. I thought of what I had seen in Fisher Ward. Madness. And pain. Minds that have been shattered. I am closer to that, I thought, than I am to recovery. Perhaps it would be best if I learnt to live with my condition after all. I could tell Dr. Nash I don't want to see him again, and I could burn my journal, burying the truths I have already learnt, hiding them as thoroughly as those I don't yet know. I would be running away from my past, but I would have no regrets. In just a few hours, I wouldn't even know that either my journal or my doctor had ever existed. And then I could live simply. One day would follow another, unconnected. Yes, occasionally the memory of Adam would surface. I would have a day of grief and pain, would remember what I miss. In just a few hours, I wouldn't even know that either my journal or my doctor had ever existed. And then I could live simply. One day would follow another, unconnected. Yes, occasionally the memory of Adam would surface. I would have a day of grief and pain, would remember what I miss. But it would not last. Before long, I would sleep and quietly forget. How easy that would be, I thought. So much easier than this. I thought of the picture I'd seen. The image was burned into me. Who did that to me? Why? I remembered the memory I'd had of the hotel room. It was still there, just under the surface, just out of reach. I had read this morning that I had reason to believe I had been having an affair, but now realized that even if that were true, I didn't know who it had been with. All I had was a single name, remembered as I woke just a few days ago. With no promise of ever remembering more, even if I wanted to. Dr. Nash was still talking. I had no idea what about, and interrupted him. "Am I getting better?" I said. A heartbeat, during which I thought he had no answer. Then he said, "Do you think you are?" Did I? I couldn't say. "I don't know, yes, I suppose so. I can remember things from my past sometimes, flashes of memory. They come to me when I read my journal. They feel real. I remember Claire, Adam, my mother, but they're like threads I can't keep hold of. Balloons that float into the sky before I can catch them. I can't remember my wedding. I can't remember Adam's first steps, his first word. I can't remember him starting at school, his graduation, anything. I don't even know if I was there. Maybe Ben decided there was no point in taking me." I took a breath. I can't even remember learning he was dead, or burying him. I began to cry. I feel like I'm going crazy. Sometimes I don't even think that he's dead. Can you believe that? Sometimes I think that Ben's lying to me about that, as well as everything else.
Everything else?
Yes, I said. My novel, The Attack. The reason I have no memory, everything.
But why do you think he would do that?
A thought came to me. Because I was having an affair? I said. Because I was unfaithful to him?
Christine, he said, that's unlikely, don't you think?
I said nothing.
He was right, of course.
Deep down, I didn't believe his lies could really be a protracted revenge for something that had happened years and years ago. The explanation was likely to be much more mundane.
"You know," said Dr. Nash, "I think you are getting better. You're remembering things, much more often than when we first met. These